KZFR Chico. Coverage coming up from Pacifica of the presidential elections and elections all over the United States. Stay tuned, please, to KZFR, kzfr.org. Thank you.
Today on Flashpoints, Greg Palast joins us for an Election Day postmortem on voter intimidation. Also, the pipeline, Hal Marin, and San Francisco financial firms are fueling the fracking boom. And we'll see if we can get in a few listener phone calls. Did you vote today? Did you commit fraud when you voted? I know you're going to tell us all of that, so we'll see if we can open up the phone lines. I'm Dennis Bernstein, all this straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. This is your daily investigative news magazine. Well, just back from the Middle West state of Ohio, the contested state, the state that decides elections, that decides who's going to rule Congress, is Greg Palast. The state is, of course, Ohio. Greg, welcome back to the West Coast. You're just in from Ohio. Do they call that the Buckeye State?
I don't know. They do. I don't know.
Do you know why? Never mind. Never mind. But Greg, hold on one second, because we got a quick report coming in from somebody who's been watching the election in another state out there in the middle. That's Wisconsin. Robbie Craig, are you there?
I am. Hi, Dennis.
Good to have you with us. I just wanted to quickly touch base before we bring Greg in to talk about what's going on in Ohio. How's it been looking in your state? Any droves of undocumented workers trying to take over the polling place, turn them upside down, and steal the election from Trump?
Not unless you consider record early voting to be that, but nothing like the Trump visions. We did have record early voting, and we had to win. We were a plaintiff in the case, a lawsuit strike down a number of Governor Walker's restrictions in early voting. But it looks like we're going to have extremely high turnout in Wisconsin, which is, in a presidential year, is good for Democrats. Here we think that Hillary probably has a safe lead, even though this is the only state where Trump outspent Hillary in television spending. But you have a razor-thin U.S. Senate race between Ron Johnson and Russ Feingold, which could determine the balance of power in the U.S. Senate. And that's the best polling would say that Russ Feingold is only up a point going into Election Day.
Up a point. Now, are you concerned that given it is so close, there could be some hanky-panky? Donald Trump is worried.
Well, I mean, the hanky-panky we've seen actually is that the dark money groups in this new deregulated post-Citizens United world have outspent Russ Feingold 5-1. And so there's just been this awash of unregulated money. You don't know who the donors are to influence this race. At this point, we don't have a Florida situation. They did gut the State Election Commission, the Government Accountability Board, but they created an evenly balanced board. In fact, our board president is the head of the Election Commission, and so it would be split on any vote. So we don't think there's a way to pull a Florida and throw it to Johnson, most likely in this state. But who knows? I mean, we don't see how it would happen. It's more of a question of whether or not Johnson could win simply with this wash of dark money that came through. Just endless ads, about half of them about made up lies about Obamacare, actually. They're trying to pull him down on for voting for Obamacare.
And so you are watching this very closely. Do you have folks around at different polls? How do you monitor the situation? Is there a complaint line? If there are any problems, how does that occur?
Yeah, we have Well, we both have a partisan part of our organization that's been doing direct electioneering, and I was out in the field in Chippewa Falls and Eau Claire yesterday with that. But today in Milwaukee, we're doing a nonpartisan program that's just trying to make sure everyone has a right to vote. So we are giving people rides to the polls. We have a huge operation at a Catholic church, but then there's also a coordinated election protection program, and our lead organizer on election issues, Anita Johnson, is in the middle of election protection, where if there is any problem at a polling place, there's a call into it, and then they figure out how to deal with it. There's a team of lawyers and a team of organizers to address any problem that comes up. And so far, things have been quite quiet, which is good news.
All right, Bob King, I hope you will keep us posted. Good luck there. Obviously, that race and whether Feingold succeeds or fails is going to be huge. So obviously,
and you're listening to FM 90.1 KZFR Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. We've got coverage of this monumental election going down right now through Pacifica, as well as Democracy Now! Stay tuned, 90.1 FM. We'll be here for the long duration of the evening here, giving you as much information as we can as this election unfolds. Polling places are open until 8 o'clock tonight. So if you're a Chico resident, a Paradise, Yuba City, wherever you are, you can probably just go online into Google, type in "where can I vote," type in your address, and it'll give you the polling place that is going to be closest to your address to get you out there and get voting. I personally went out and voted today. I consider myself the winner today because I voted once and got two stickers. We'll be right back with more coverage of this election here on FM 90.1 KZFR Chico. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Radio Paradise on Community Radio at 90.1 FM, KZFR, Chico.
Thank you very much for joining us. This is FM 90.1 KZFR Chico. We're going to go to live coverage of this election from Democracy Now. You can catch Democracy Now here on KZFR Chico every weekday, 8 to 9 a.m. The big day. Get your stickers. Get out there and vote.
Ralph Nader wants to butt in Washington, D.C. You're sort of the odd man here.
Yeah, I think we should make a closer link between domestic policy and an interventionist militaristic foreign policy. Militaristic foreign policy is destroying this country. All empires eventually destroy themselves. That's the record of history. And the issue of empire, the dominant global power, Hillary Clinton calls it global leadership, has been taken off the table. It hardly was discussed. Bernie Sanders didn't spend much time on it. Trump threw some epithets about, you know, why don't we get along with Putin? But he wants to smash his way through the world, and he wants a bigger military. So I think we should discuss what's going to happen in the interregnum before the inauguration in January to bring Hillary Clinton to her senses in terms of talking more about waging peace, about international treaty negotiations. There is no effort coming out of her record to bring up to date nuclear arms agreements with Russia and China and others. There is no indication of a treaty negotiation for cyber warfare, as we both engage in it between the U.S. and other countries, rising to critical masses here. And, of course, on the Middle East itself, it's nothing but brute force. That's all she's talking about. The Israeli-Palestinian conflict, which has radiating impacts throughout that whole area, is like off the table. So why don't we talk a little bit about that, especially since we have one of the country's greatest experts from Columbia University on Middle East politics and American policy.
Yeah, well, Rashid, I would like to ask you about that in terms of how you see with either candidate winning. You know, there's been a lot of talk about the rise of the Latino vote in this in this election because of Trump's anti-immigrant positions. But there's been little discussion of the Muslim community in the United States, how it is seeing this election, and also what impact they can have on U.S. policy in the Middle East.
Well, they have to organize themselves like other communities have. I mean, you have to get yourself to the table, and they're not yet quite there. But I think that in terms of voting, you're going to see a lot of votes going against Trump just because of his horrific anti-Muslim positions.
And this certainly wasn't always the case with Muslims and the Republican Party.
Not at all. A lot of Muslims, a lot of Arab Americans, Muslim Americans were very attracted to the Republican Party, conservative social values and so on. But Trump has horrified them. So I think there will be a big vote. The problem is these are people in states like New Jersey, which has already gone for Hillary Clinton, and Michigan. Now, maybe in Michigan they'll have an impact.
They might have an impact in Michigan. Looks like it's more in play than we thought it was a week ago.
Exactly.
And so, you know, if the Muslim community in Michigan comes out strongly, I think they will make a difference.
Well, let's talk about that. Isn't it one of the largest Muslim communities in the United States, Dearborn, Michigan?
The Detroit area is the largest concentration of Arab Americans and Muslim Americans, but they have to organize themselves. Neither party has reached out to them. Secretary Clinton said things that were actually almost insulting. Mm-hmm. You have to basically spy on each other because we are afraid some of you are disloyal. Instead of saying, you are Americans, we respect you, we want you. She made no outreach to Muslim Americans or Arab Americans.
How is Khizr Khan fit into this story?
Well, that was a wonderful thing. because, of course, you have to be a soldier and a veteran or a soldier who sacrificed your life for your country.
His son.
To get his son, to get onto the national radar. But it was a very good thing. But actual outreach
time,
to Arab Americans
think?
And Muslim Americans, we really didn't see. So they're going to have to put themselves at the table.
You know, but at the same time, don't you think that the relationship that the two of them have developed can be used to incent her?
I hope
to
begin so.
To talk to more Muslim Americans? Because I think that
so.
there's a clear respect there. He has gone beyond just using the convention platform to go out and do, you know, serious service.
Here's her con, and she made a commercial with him directly address Donald Trump. But let's go beyond to the issue of empire, as you describe it.
Right,
Israel,
right.
Palestine, Syria, Russia.
Well, several things. First of all, Russia. Russia and Iran are not going to allow the Assad regime to fall. This administration talked to, and the French and many other countries said, we want to bring the Assad regime down. You want to bring the Assad regime down? You have to beat the Russians and the Iranians in Syria. That is not going to happen. Like it, don't like it, it's not going to be very pleasant. But instead of deciding, which I think the president actually wanted to do, not only not to intervene, but not to allow American allies to intervene, essentially we have a free-for-all where so-called American allies are actually supporting some of the nastiest, most extreme Islamist radicals in the business, including people who are associated with al-Qaeda. I mean, how much worse can you get? We are actually, we and our allies. And so there are multiple problems there. How you deal with the Russians, which is not just Syria, which is also NATO. President Bush Sr. and Secretary Baker, way back when, told Gorbachev, we're not going to advance NATO into Eastern Europe. We're not going to advance NATO into East Germany if you allow the unification of Germany. Where is that pledge? Where is the logic behind a military alliance devised in the time of communism before the Berlin Wall fell, now being in the Ukraine, in Poland, in Estonia, in Latvia, and Lithuania? I don't understand. Now, if you talk as Ralph did, or as Jill Stein did, about militarism and the arms industry, well, you can see the logic behind it. But I cannot see the logic in terms of national interests and a sane relationship with Russia or any other country. And those things all have to be addressed. And they haven't been a part of the debate.
And one country where President Obama, along with Hillary Clinton, did succeed in toppling a leader was Libya with Gaddafi. And now we have the Republicans focusing more on Benghazi than on the failed state that resulted from that policy.
Exactly.
What do you think what pressure can be brought to bear on a Clinton administration on Libya?
The Clinton administration is going to have to get tough with American allies. There is a civil war in Libya going on with the British on one side, the French on the other side, with the Egyptians and the Emirates on one side and Qatar on the other side. American allies using American weapons, NATO allies, are fighting each other through Libyans, one group supporting the Benghazi group, government, and one group supporting the Tripoli government. I mean, the President of the United States should get up and say, either arms embargo on countries that are using American weapons to fight other American allies? I mean, really? Seriously? And in the middle, you have the Islamic State taking advantage, of course. We have an even worse situation in Syria, where the United States allies are actually supporting people who are violently opposed to the United States, who are dangerous, radical Islamist fanatics. I mean, where is the logic of that? When are we going to call the Saudis on the support of intolerant, bigoted, fanatical types of Islam? When are we going to call this ally?
Well, I mean, President Obama visited Saudi Arabia more than some American states. Why this relationship?
Money, Boeing, General Dynamics, real estate, Citibank, oil. I mean, you just have to talk about the people who buy and own senators and have more lobbyists.
Made the largest weapons deal in the history of
precisely.
The world
I
with Saudi
Arabia.
I believe
$40 billion in 2012.
As it's pulverizing Yemen.
All American weapons. My daughter's an archaeologist. The museum that all of the work that she and three other teams deposit, all of the artifacts that they deposited in the museum in a place called Damar was flattened. No military target. Saudis just took it out. And that's happened all over Yemen. They're not just killing people, they're destroying heritage sites. Those are American weapons.
And there's nothing about, to your view, in your mind, is there anything about Hillary Clinton's foreign policy agenda that would suggest that the fundamentals of that reality will change?
You know, one of the things that the president did that I was the most supportive of was his opening to Iran. If she can maintain that that openness to Iran, a willingness to at least see if Iran's policies can be moderated, that would be a good thing. I'm not terribly optimistic. I mean, look at the people that she's so far surrounded herself with. That's what really concerns me.
There's no inclination. I don't think that there's any inclination that she would discontinue, you know, some of the Obama openness.
I hope so.
The way that they've worked together, especially in this past several months, suggests that there have been conversations about some fluidity and continuity. John Kerry, certainly, as Secretary of State, has done the work. And so I really don't... I'm optimistic.
When you say Obama openness, you mean Obama openness with regards to Iran?
Or yes.
Obama openness with regards to drone wars? Obama's openness with regards to the five fronts that he... I'm just trying to be clear about what
we mean.
Well,
I'm talking about Iran, Eddie, and I think you knew that. I think you knew that. You're smart enough to have known that.
He's trying to get a point in there. Part of what I want to say is that there's some consistency here across. Yeah. So what we... In some ways, the buy that we're giving Hillary Clinton in the public debate around foreign policy... Many folks on the left, or many folks who've supported Obama, have given him a buy with regards to his positions, with regards to foreign policy.
The thing that kills me about hawkish interventionist Democrats, the thing that just disturbs me about them, is that they will never win over the Republican base, which just wants to bomb and kill and have the United States intervene everywhere. They should do what, at least on Iran, the president did. Ignore those people. Face them down. Succeed with your policy and show that you can do something else than use force and bully your way around the world. I'm not terribly optimistic because she is surrounded by people like Michel Flournoy, who she may become Secretary of Defense, by people like Victoria Nuland, who was in the Maidan agitating for the Ukraine to enter NATO. She was Assistant Secretary for Eastern Europe.
When
Secretary Clinton was in at the State Department. Dennis Ross, who sabotaged what the President and Senator Mitchell were trying to do between the Palestinians and the Israelis. Mitchell was a presidential envoy. Dennis Ross was picked up by Hillary and brought over to the State Department when she was Secretary of State. So, I mean, if she follows some of the leads that the president followed, we might be better off. I hope she will.
One of the challenges, though, I think, is that Americans are not sufficiently vested in foreign policy.
Right.
So while people are prepared to talk about Social Security, about marriage equality, about any number of other issues, people are not prepared, your layperson is not prepared to have a conversation about foreign policy. And we have a very large military community, veterans and others, who basically do believe in the militarism. And so one of the challenges...
Some do and some don't. Some of my best students are veterans who've been in Iraq and Afghanistan and understand perfectly well the stupidity of those policies, that you cannot export revolution, progress by force of arms.
Ralph Nader, your response on that issue.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, Veterans for Peace, for example, had an occasion in Washington, D.C. It was blanked out by the Washington Post and the media. But if you poll a lot of returning veterans, before they returned, they came out against continued U.S. presence in these countries. They say, the people don't want us there. What are we doing? We're only going to make more enemies, spread more attacks all over in that area.
They know
it's coming here. Here's the thing. For anybody here who's very worried about domestic priorities, just consider, we have created, with this war on terrorism, more fighters, more countries embroiled. They're learning new weapons. They're learning new techniques. They're coming here in social media. The lone wolf thing is expanding. And once that blows here, then forget about domestic priorities. It'll be total blacked out and crowded out with terror, terror, terror. And that's why Hillary Clinton's got to be extremely careful and restrain her hawkishness and have a Department of Peace effort in the State Department instead of a militarized State Department goading the Defense Department to be more interventionist.
Do you think, Professor Rashid Khalidi, that Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State and now has learned anything from the debacle in Libya? Does she consider it a debacle? And do you see her doing the same thing in Syria?
I don't know what she considers. I mean, it was a partisan issue. She's not going to say anything about it. I have no idea. I'm deeply concerned about the kind of people she surrounded herself with in the past.
Mm-hmm.
I hope that she's learned from some of the things that this administration tried to do, and in many cases, unfortunately, failed to do, and from some of the bad things that this administration has done, to follow less less foolish and dangerous.
Speaking
policies.
Of veterans and also the Israel-Palestine conflict, Mark Kirk, who just mm-hmm. lost his Senate seat in Illinois, was the number one recipient of pro-Israel money. This according to Nathan Gutman of The Forward.
Interesting. Mm. Interesting. I mean, I haven't talked about Palestine, but that's another place where this president actually, to his credit, with Senator Mitchell, tried to do the right thing, which is to actually bring all of the Palestinians, including Hamas, imagine that, Hamas, to the table. And Mitchell had the track record to do that because he brought the IRA to the table in Ireland. And that was derailed by the lobby, with the point man on that being Dennis Ross. At state.
And I still remember resounding in my ears Hillary Clinton's, the candidate's speech at AIPAC.
Yeah.
And it was not a speech that would give one
on the other hand, she has had a very rough experience with with Benjamin Netanyahu.
So the
president's very difficult relationship may well carry over there. And I mean, the day that an American Democratic president realizes that the base of the Democratic Party has moved, and just because a lot of rich people give her money and want her to keep the policy on Israel, does not mean that the American Jewish community or young Americans
absolutely.
Or Latino or African American or the other people who make up the base of the party support those policies.
Absolutely.
They don't. And that the change is extremely rapid.
Oh, I want to interrupt just with an update. Looks like it's going to be a long night here. CNN, with 88% of the vote counted in Florida, Trump leads Hillary Clinton by 28 votes.
Wow.
Meanwhile, the races are also too close to call in North Carolina, New Hampshire, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Virginia.
Pennsylvania?
So we're having, and in North Carolina, with 55% of the vote counted, Clinton is ahead 51.6% to Trump's 46%. So I think what you were saying about North Carolina, she does seem to be opening a lead there.
And I'm wondering if Brown or Miami-Dade report fully yet in
Florida. And with 56% of the vote in North Carolina, Deborah Ross is at 49.5%, Richard Burr 47.5%.
And since Durham is still open, I mean, that's a city, heavily African-American.
They're still voting, actually.
Yeah, they're still voting until 9 o'clock, 8:30 or 9 o'clock. So, and if you're in North Carolina, get to the polls, please. Please, baby, please, baby, please.
Final comments, Professor mm-hmm. Halliday, because I know you have to leave now,
right.
On what you want to see happen and what you think Donald Trump has exposed or what he put forward when it came to Israel, Russia, Palestine, Syria.
You know, he wasn't saying anything consistent or sensible about foreign policy. So to talk about the Trump foreign policy as laid out in this ridiculous campaign is almost impossible.
Well, as he said, he didn't want to reveal anything to the enemy.
Exactly. he did say a couple sensible things about Russia. I mean, Russia is a difficult country to deal with, but I think that our policy on Russia has been foolish in the extreme. There's absolutely no reason for NATO to be sticking its fingers up the nostrils of Russia at every orifice. I mean, it's absurd. It's absolutely absurd. And they're not going to give up easily on Syria. They've had a relationship with that country since 19. It's very close to them. It's like the Bahamas or Nicaragua for us. It's important to them. So you're going to have to cut a deal. And you're going to have to tame your allies. And so I very much, I don't think Trump is capable. I don't think Trump can understand what we're talking. I mean, he really is a, he actually had an affection for that model of leader, I think. Who am I to say?
He's been on record as talking about
And remember, this is FM 90.1 KZFR Chico. Listen to support community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. Getting as much live coverage as we can covering this big election 2016, Trump versus Hillary. and Jill Stein and Gary Johnson. Can't forget about that one. Get out there. Polls are open until 8 o'clock. You can simply go onto Google and then type in where to vote. You can put in your address, and then it'll show you where a good polling place in your area, one that you're actually supposed to go to, is going to be available. So stay tuned with us here on KZFR. Chico, we're going to be getting as much election coverage as we can directly to you on the airwaves, in your speakers and headphones. A quick music break to cleanse the palate, and we'll be right back.
Want to do something between elections back home and congressional districts, because Congress liberals, and there are a lot of them that aren't publicized back home, can overcome corporate forces in Washington. And that's what this book is about, the basic citizen summons of members of Congress to town meetings around agendas created by the citizenry back home, turning the complete dynamic from members of Congress choreographing the mass of the people and flattering them to members of Congress being tutored and being accountable to open town meetings all over the country. Less than 1% can pull her off.
What you were saying earlier, you're talking about a mass gathering of people. If Hillary Clinton is elected tonight or tomorrow, and we can talk about what it means if Donald Trump is elected, or perhaps you would just say either. When you were talking about Bernie Sanders and what he is calling our revolution.
Yes, he's out with a book. He's campaigning. With decentralized rallies around the country behind the progressive agenda. So he has real power in the Senate, because Hillary Clinton's going to be very worried about the 2018 Senate races, where three times more Democrats are going to be up than Republicans. And she, even if she wins the Senate now, she can lose it dramatically in 2018. The country. But I've often bewailed Bernie because he's been a lone ranger for so long. He just doesn't return calls. He doesn't network community groups the way Senator Paul Wellstone did. But he's got to change. He broke new ground. He showed you can raise $235 million in tiny denominations for forsaking super PACs and fat cat fundraisers in Beverly Hills. Now he's got to go to a new level. He'll have Sherrod Brown. He'll have Elizabeth Warren. He'll have some new senators, Russ Feingold. Otherwise, it's another status quo extension of what we've seen getting worse under Hillary Clinton, the candidate of Wall Street and war.
But, Ralph, as you know, transforming an election movement into some sort of more lasting organization is a tough task. Didn't Bernie Sanders start out initially trying to create a new political organization to put forth his political revolution, but immediately ran into troubles with differences between himself and some of the key organizers?
Those were staff revolts against Mr. Weaver, the person running our revolution. But that's abated now because they've left, and they can raise a lot of money. And by the way, Bernie has support from populist super PACs that are now developing, using social media to raise large amounts of money in small denominations. I think if Mr. Weaver starts taking money from big corporations, that's what I think is reflected in your question, Juan. That is going to dilute and compromise the effort. But they don't need to do that because the technicians, the geniuses who raised the money for them, now are saying that it can continue year after year, which is quite an unprecedented base of resource and full-time organizers that progressive groups have not been used to for the last century.
So why does it have to happen at the level of at the level of Bernie Sanders organizing? Why can't it be at the level of a number of local mass mobilizations that then have a national implication? In other words, why do we need to rely on Bernie Sanders, the charisma of Bernie Sanders, or the infrastructure of Bernie Sanders' election campaign in order to have the kind of wildcat expressions, as it were, of organizing, of mass mobilization in places all across the country? Why do
You don't.
Well,
you don't need
that.
You're quite right. You don't need that.
Right.
You're quite right. You don't need that. I'm just talking about his impact in Congress, that he's got to have a base. But the base is never going to grow without having local fervor and local organizing on issues that are all over the country. You're
right.
Quite right there. But in terms of the way the Clintons choreographed the Congress and how many deals they're going to cut with the Republicans, like repatriating trillions of dollars of profits over from overseas for a very small tax tab, which they're already talking to Paul Ryan and McConnell about. That's where Bernie has to have a base. But there's no base without local power.
Bernie has the momentum, and I think that that's something that we can't ignore. You have a lot of young people who still feel somewhat marginalized, even if they do vote for Hillary. They still say they feel the burn. So, you know, the challenge, I think Ralph has pointed out very well, is that Bernie seems to not have the personality to engage with people at the grassroots level, this distance between he and others. But I was with an organization called Democracy. What was it, Democracy? Education Anew. And they were looking, juvenile justice people. I was with them in Memphis on Saturday. And these young organizers were extremely impressive in talking about doing things like putting together town hall meetings and bringing people together to have those conversations. I think it has to be something quite simultaneous, that something is happening. But the lesson has to be for our voters that voting is not the most you can do. It's really the least you can do. I mean, Hillary should be worried about 2018. Because we could very well have major losses in the Senate. And we should all be worried about 2020, because does the Trump, assuming that Hillary wins, does the Trump machine come roaring back again?
And we are not there yet. Hillary Clinton has not been coronated yet. By the way, NBC News has called the House of Representatives for the Republicans. We'll see what happens in the Senate, but it is a serious blow to the Democrats' desires to take the Senate with Todd Young, the Republican, winning the Indiana Senate seat, taking beating out Evan Bayh. Also, Nate Silver of 538, known for some accurate predictions, said Republicans' chances of winning the Senate are up to 69% after Indiana and Florida calls for the GOP. Again, Marco Rubio has retained his seat, despite saying he would not run for that seat. But then, of course, once he gave up his presidential bid, went back to that. The difference between the moment when President Obama was elected back in 2008, Ralph, and today, if Hillary Clinton is elected, back in 2008 with that election, all the different movements joining together to elect President Obama. He immediately said he was going to close Guantanamo in a year. He was going to end the wars, a number of other things. Became the, as many of his allies called him in the immigration rights movement, the deporter in chief, deporting more, and this continues, immigrants than any president in history. Not closing Guantanamo. Afghanistan is the longest war in U.S. history. But people backed off, maybe partly because of the racist attack on him. The birther movement among those who led it was Donald Trump, and they didn't want to contribute to that. And they thought he would actually do this, and it might have been a great disservice to him and to this country, thinking that one person could do it alone. But there's certainly nothing like that feeling when it comes to Hillary Clinton. I mean, the unfavorability ratings that they keep touting today, talking about in all the polls that have been done, are enormously high. The issue of trust, especially among millennials, but going across the population, even if she's elected, even by those who elected her, the lack of trustworthiness that people feel that she has. In one sense, people are already chomping at the bit, waiting to, you know, race out of the gate. Would you say that, Ralph Nader?
Yeah, well, we would like to see that happen. But, you know, it just doesn't happen without full-time organizers. You know, look at any movement in our country's history. Was there a labor movement without full-time organizers in the field? Civil rights movement, full-time organizers in the field? Women's rights movement? And we never ask that question. Progressives never ask that question. When you say, why don't we have full Medicare for all with free choice of doctor and hospital, half as expensive as it is now? Look at Canada, better outcomes. Nobody says, well, you know, there isn't a dozen full-time people in around the country pushing for it. When the Pentagon isn't audited, half of the government's operating budget going crazy with waste and corruption and redundancy, how many people are there around the country trying to get the audit of the Pentagon? Zero. Zero, zero. That's why we've got to deploy into the congressional districts and just say, look, it's Congress that is on the table here. You're not going to deal with the judiciary. You're not going to deal with the executive branch unless you deal with Congress, which has the taxing power, the spending power, the investigative power, the confirmation of nomination power, and, of course, the taxing power and the war power. So that's where the emphasis has got to be. How many organizers can you field is always the question that should be asked.
Well, Ralph, on another topic, if Hillary Clinton does win, she has promised to move forward on comprehensive immigration reform in her first 100 days. Now, of course, we heard from President Obama when he was running in 2008 that he would move on immigration reform. That didn't happen. Do you think that even if the Republicans retain the Senate, that there's been enough of a experience of the Republican Party with the suicidal nature, they're continuing not to deal with this issue of what to do with immigration in this country, that there'll be a majority to be able to achieve comprehensive immigration reform? I'd like to ask you and the other panelists as well.
I think if it reaches a point where both parties want to get it off the table and put it behind them, they can come together. But only if the pressure, the turmoil that the non-resolution of the immigration issue continues to put the pressure. There are times, you know, when both parties in Congress just want to get rid of an issue. Like they want to get rid of the Palestinian-Israeli issue. So they resolve it in favor of the Israeli military machine and occupation. So I think that, one, that's what's going to have to happen. It's got to be, and it's got to involve a lot of elements in our society other than the people who have most at stake.
You know, with Marco Rubio going back to the Senate, it's bad news for the Democrats in terms of the count, but it may be decent news in terms of immigration reform. He actually, before he tilted as he was running for president, had worked with a bipartisan group in putting together a plan that did have some reasonable features to it. And so that's something that perhaps he and Hillary Clinton can work together on. But I think Ralph is right. You've got to have the disruption and you've got to have the pain. But this is something that isn't going to go away. The fact is that Mexico is our contiguous neighbor. The fact is that we actually took Mexico, and so maybe they're coming to take it back. Not so sure about that. But in any case, the fact is our contiguous neighbor and we are interdependent. And so it's not going to go away. And the piecemeal reforms that we've so often seen are not good. We need something that's very comprehensive that talks about protecting the people whose families are here so that you're not deporting parents while their children are here. And we need to talk about how people are able to get their citizenship. What's a path to citizenship that does not force them to leave the country?
Well, I think it's going to be a very difficult issue to come out of the blocks. and embrace. And it has everything to do with what we're hearing now in the echo chamber about she has to bring the country together. And so when I'm listening to Republicans and people on the right, the thing that they're talking about is just she needs to come out and hit the issue or the question around infrastructure. That's something that both sides can come to terms with, come together on. But I think what's going to drive immigration reform, right, is the indisputable fact of the Latino vote. If the numbers are what we think they are, and the community is as organized as it looks to be, there is going to be pressure from below, I think, to bring this issue to some form of resolution. So I agree Marco Rubio opens up space. I agree that Hillary Clinton, in relation to this issue, we want it to go away. But at the end of the day, it's going to have to be pressure from organized people to get this issue resolved. And I think what we're seeing in this election cycle is that the Latino community is preparing itself. As complicated and differentiated as the community is, it's preparing itself to bring pressure to bear, not only around immigration, but also around the question of Puerto Rico. Right, there's going to be some pressure to be brought to bear, and what it's going to look like, how she's going to respond, I'm not sure.
You know, the Latino community, however, needs to be well advised to deal with allies in the progressive community that are non-Latino. I mean, one of the big challenges we had, and Mr. Trump articulated some of this, but many others have, is the black-brown tension that sometimes is there and sometimes is not. Latinos do not take black jobs. Undocumented people are not taking black people's jobs. I mean, first of all, nobody had their name on a job. But secondly, when you look at the giving people, making people legal, makes labor competition a different kind of animal. Yeah. When you can pay somebody less than you're paying somebody else, of course you're going to hire the person that you can pay under the table. And so it makes sense. But I think that the Latino community is going to have to open up conversations with progressive African Americans so that we move together on a united
front
around some
of these issues. And we see examples of this, for example, with Dream Defenders in Florida, right? We see this extraordinary grassroots organization that has been on the front lines with regards to immigration reform, with regards to protecting undocumented workers, as well as, right, speaking to the question of police brutality. And this goes to the earlier point that Ralph Nader made about organizers, right? And I think it's important to kind of link that point to the presence of Rashid Robinson earlier, right, in Color of Change and the Super PAC, and how and the Super PAC around DAs, right, and how it linked up with organizers like Asada's Daughters and Project NEA and BYP 100 in Chicago and Black Lives Matter, or movements for Black Lives Matter policy platform, where you see folks who are not kind of focused simply on this electoral cycle, but really thinking about organizing and conceiving of a broader kind of politics that goes beyond just simply coronating the next president, as it were.
I know. I don't know why y'all keep saying coronating, because I don't see any coronation. This woman has fought like hell. If she wins, she's fought like hell.
A lot of folks are coronated.
I don't see it as a coronation at all, Eddie.
Well, let's get to that issue in a minute, but I do want to ask Ralph Nader, before you leave, Ralph, about any of the ballot initiatives you're particularly following. I want to comment that marijuana legalization on the ballot in 9 states. And right now, it looks like Florida voters have overwhelmingly approved an amendment legalizing medical marijuana. I think it's something like 5% of the population could legally partake in marijuana before today. And if all of the amendments, the ballot initiatives pass, it'll be a quarter of the country, which is quite astounding. Mm-hmm. What else are you looking at? In addition, will you want to comment on marijuana?
Three quick comments. 4 states have a minimum wage on, and in 2012, 4 conservative states passed minimum wage, such as Arkansas. Maybe that'll build up the pressure on Congress to lift up the ossified $7.25 federal minimum wage. So that's a good sign. I think they're going to win. The $2 additional tax on tobacco in California is a good one, too, because the money's going to be used for good purposes. But here's the dilemma. You have 9 states going for legalization of marijuana. You have no efforts dealing with industrial hemp, which can create all kinds of jobs and has thousands of uses, but is banned in terms of growing in this country. We import it from Canada.
We're experiencing a little of a buffering here on the website that we're getting the feed from, so I'll put on some Radio Paradise so we get it back.
Getting off the DEA prescribed list, one of the greatest plants in the history of the world, industrial hemp. Isn't that amazing? A dichotomy that nobody's talking about?
I will also say, though, Florida, according to the Drug Policy Alliance, did become the first state in the South to legalize medical marijuana. And again, for those, it's been legalized for those with specific medical conditions, including cancer, epilepsy, glaucoma, Parkinson's, MS. It would not legalize non-medical use of, or possession. Other initiatives. We're talking about over 160. There's more now than there's been in a decade, Ralph.
Yeah, there, a lot of them are reforms of governmental processes, as in Connecticut, for example. The important thing about the initiative process is to begin to shield it from corporate takeover. So they use the initiative process. It's very encouraging that there are a record number of statewide initiatives in the country, but we need to get more states to adopt the initiative referendum recall east of the Mississippi, where there aren't that many.
69, the citizen-initiated constitutional amendment, which if passed would finance universal health care.
Yes, that's another good one in Colorado. That's a nip-and-tuck race. Colorado could be the first to have single payer, in effect, and that could spread around the country. But let's face it, there are certain things that have to be done through Congress. That's why I emphasize in my book, Breaking Through Power, the growth of Congress watchdog groups. If they reflect majority opinion, Amy, they can defeat the health insurance industrial complex. They can defeat corporate power as long as they represent a growing left-right consensus of Main Street over Wall Street against the concentrated takeover of the corporate state, they can defeat it. We've got to get very, very zero-focused, laser-focused on 535 people. 20% of them are already on the side of progressive causes.
Big Pharma has poured $100 million into the ballot initiative in California that would reduce the costs of drugs.
There's an example. All that initiative does is say that California buying drugs shouldn't pay more than what the Veterans Administration or the Department of Defense pay in terms of mass wholesale bargaining. And they're putting $100 million to defeat that. They're using the initiative process to boomerang against the state legislature, because state legislature says, oh, gee, lost in the vote. What are we going to do in Sacramento? So it nullifies the overwhelming Democratic Party control of the state legislature.
I'd like to ask Eddie Claude about a subject that hasn't received much attention, but definitely has had an impact on voting in this race, which is you're a professor at Princeton University. The skyrocketing cost of higher education and student debt, to what degree the despair over many young people about their student debt helped fuel their support first of Bernie Sanders and now may have an impact on this race as well?
Absolutely, and Julianne can talk about this as well. I mean, we know that student debt sits high on the agenda of students as they in some ways try to imagine not only the value of their degree but the prospects of their future, and so they're asking questions, and they're asking questions of this two-party duopoly, whether or not Democrats are on the side of
stress. Why don't we go out tonight? Put on your favorite.
I've taught a
seminar on James Baldwin this past Monday, and there were some students, this was their first election, participating in their first election. Data suggests that. And what they are saying is that they actually find themselves repulsed by the entire process, because they don't feel as if Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump offers viable solutions to the problems that they think they will face. And so I think it's absolutely, I think you're absolutely right.
When we look at student debt, and we look at the whole cost of higher ed is one issue, and we've seen just the unbridled increases in the cost of higher ed, almost twice as rapid as inflation, and even more in these past few years when you haven't seen inflation increasing. Average student graduating with roughly $30,000 worth of debt, but nearly half of all students having no debt, which means that the average is much higher, something closer to $60,000. African American students having even more debt, and the Pell Grant having been flat. Almost twice as rapid as inflation, $1,000, come to school with a guaranteed roughly $5,500. Where does the rest of their money come from? It's basically loans, unless they're brilliant and have lots of scholarships. Bernie excited people by talking about free tuition, but from my perspective, first of all, it was at public schools, so I was a president of a private college. So for those who are private colleges, that's a big question mark. But secondly, he never said how it was going to be. Average person buys a home at whatever year, but now it's pushed back out. So it's a serious issue that, I, as you say, people have dipped around it, but they had not talked about it comprehensively. And I don't think that either the Hillary plan nor the Bernie plan was a perfect plan.
We have to break for just a minute, and then we're going to come back at 9 o'clock Eastern time. A lot of polls have closed so far, more than half the polls in the country have. For staying with us. Thomas Franks is also going to join us, as is Reverend Barber. Stay with us.